and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the Rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
As you know, Californians, or Angelinos in particular, voted for Measure M, which gives the city of Los Angeles something that almost no other city has at this time, which is an unlimited source in perpetuity of funding for mass transit projects. Is that going to result in a state-of-the-art mass transit system for the most traffic-snarled city in the country and one of the most traffic-snarled cities in the world? Or is it just going to be another boondoggle? Let's find out from a guy who is an expert, a world expert on urban life and specifically Los Angeles. He's one of our faves. Wrote a piece in the Daily Beast called "Will Donald Trump Expose America's Great Mass Transit Hoax?" It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Joel Kotkin. Joel, welcome back. How are you?
Nice to be here.
And, of course, teaches at Chapman University in the beautiful city of Orange. So Measure M dollars gives Los Angeles a source of funding for transit projects that would be the envy, really, of pretty much any city on Earth and certainly any American city. And where do we go with this? Are we spending it wisely, or are we about to, you know, go off on pet projects like, you know, safer streets and bike lanes and all this other stuff?
Well, there's no question where it's going. I mean, look, somebody ought to look at the evidence. If we have spent $15 to $16 billion on, you know, particularly mostly on sort of the light rail subway projects, and the percentage of people, the share of people taking transit has dropped, maybe we should be thinking, are we doing the right thing? Are we spending this money correctly? I mean, the vision that we now have for L.A., frankly, is to turn it into some sort of dense, transit-riding city, but it doesn't work because people don't, transit doesn't meet the needs of most people. Unless you live along the line and you are going downtown, it's pretty worthless. You know, I mean, we can see because the numbers are so poor, but we could be investing in new technologies. You know, certainly, you know, Uber, Lyft, dial-a-ride services. We could you know, help with the buses, which are, you know, really serve the people who really, you know, really have to use transit and is much more flexible. But instead, we're going to build this. And frankly, I think it's, you know, who's behind it? I mean, part of it is, you know, sort of Jerry Brown's, you know, anti-suburban mentality. Some of it is the fact that there are all these engineering companies and consultants who make money on these things. And the third thing is that there are these developers who, you know, even though it turns out that most people who live in the, quote, transit-oriented developments don't even take transit, they can speculate on it. And by making it necessary that you have to have a strong transit connection, you sort of limited where things can be built. And so if you own property in areas that are designated as transit-friendly, you make a lot of money. I mean, it's not hard to figure out. This is nothing really to do with making mobility better. It's really all about, you know, money and an attempt, which, frankly, I think it is now so far gone that I don't think there's any way of reversing it, is to turn L.A. into sort of this kind of high-density dystopia where it's extremely difficult to live unless you're very wealthy or you're dependent on the state.
Joel, let me ask you a bunch of questions, because I supported Measure M, because, you know, in Jerry Brown 1.0, when he was governor back 30-plus years ago, his model was everybody's here so we don't have to build infrastructure anymore, and we didn't build it, and it came anyway. And all the demographers that I've talked to over the years are saying that the population of California will hit 50 million in a not-too-distant future. And we continue to widen, for instance, the 405, and before the project is even finished, it's obsolete because of just demographic growth. While I agree with you that the light rail system we currently have is inadequate because when you get off the train, you're still 5 miles or 10 miles from where you need to go, and until we have a feeder system like in Manhattan or New York City, you get off a train and it's a short walk to any place. And that's not the situation here, but we're building the system. So if you roll this out 20, 30 years in the future, I mean, we could have said the same thing about the Manhattan, the New York City subway system while it was under construction, that there were neighborhoods that it was completely impractical to use. But over time, it became unthinkable to have the city without a light rail system.
Look, I grew up in New York. Let me just tell you, first of all, much of the subway system, particularly in the outer boroughs, was built actually before there were very many people out there.
Right, and it made it possible for them to live there, because I grew up in New York, right, too. I lived on the 7 line, you know, for years, taking a train in from Shea Stadium.
But the reality is, and it's not just L.A., every city whose growth took place predominantly after 1950, that's built the transit system, almost everyone has failed. Almost everyone has seen a decline in people taking transit. It's not necessarily the transit at fault. It's the way we're spending the money. It's where, what sort of technologies we're using, which are, you know, basically 19th century technologies. I mean, they even want to bring back trolleys, which are insane. It's 15 miles an hour. I don't think it's going to help very much. All the stuff that you've been talking about with the narrowing of the lanes and the stuff that Garcetti's doing, this is all part of the same thing. The goal of our current ruling class is to turn people into apartment dwelling transit riders, and, you know, taking away the very quality of life that people
I don't disagree with you that, and we've argued this till we're blue in the face, that the blunder here is that the philosopher kings down there on Spring Street are taking lanes away and deliberately creating gridlock to harass people out of their cars to use a public transportation system that in many cases doesn't exist, which is insane. But the thing is, the city is getting there's no way to avoid the density. Either that, or Los Angeles will simply be a place where you're going to pay $3 million for a two-bedroom fixture in Van Nuys. I mean, that's just where we're headed.
Well, but the reality is, when you talk about these demographic projections, actually the projections have been so far off, because I think the SCAG projections, if we go back, 20 or 30 years, about 3 million less people than they projected. When a place is expensive and its economy is not generating lots of great jobs, its population doesn't grow. L.A.'s population growth rate is well below the national average now. We're not growing particularly quickly, actually. Immigration to Southern California is down. And here's a really interesting point, which I've written quite a bit about. We have had the biggest drop in the number of children of any metropolitan area in the country.
Yeah, that's because people can't afford to have a family here. They can't afford to have kids here, because if you want an extra bedroom, the house is going to cost you $800,000.
So right, exactly. And then, particularly in much of L.A. County, particularly in the L.A. city, the schools are not very good.
Right,
either.
Exactly.
So then you're probably adding, like, one of the reasons we moved to Orange County was because I didn't want to pay, an extra $230,000 for my 13-year-old to go to school.
We're talking with Joel Kotkin, who's the presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University, and he wrote a piece with Wendell Cox for the Daily Beast called "Will Donald Trump Expose America's Great Mass Transit Hoax?" What do you mean by Donald Trump? What will President Trump's involvement in this? What could it be?
Well, that was unfortunately their headline that they wrote. I mean, I think Donald Trump is incapable of doing almost anything, so except annoying people. So, I don't think he's going to get anywhere. What I think may happen is there may be some greater skepticism about this idea that you can turn, the 21st century city into a 19th century city. I think that is something different. One of the things that kills me is there are no incentives, for instance, for people working at home. You want to reduce people on the road? A lot of people could work at home. They don't. When I used to live in Los Angeles and I worked at home, I had to pay a big tax for not being contributing to all the congestion. So I think there are many ways that we could use new technologies to get where we want to go, and we're not doing that. We're doing something that has clearly not worked. I mean, if you read the paper that we recently did at Chapman, one of the things that's really interesting is all these systems are doing badly. Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, even Portland has seen a drop in the percentage of people who take transit. So something is wrong. And part of it is we don't live in a transit-oriented world anymore. Places like what we call legacy cities, like New York, Boston, even to some extent San Francisco, were built before the car. And so their structures, they have much bigger downtowns. They have much more centralized employment. That's not the nature. Actually, in Southern California, we're dispersing employment because that's sort of the natural tendency. So we have to figure out a transit and transportation solution that makes sense to us instead of trying to duplicate what New York developed over 100 years ago.
Joel, thanks so much. We always appreciate when you come on. You can follow Joel Kotkin on Twitter at Joel Kotkin, K-O-T-K-I-N. Joel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Whenever there's anything in the news about the retail industry, we always put out the old bat signal to talk with Howard Davidowitz, consultant to the retail industry and president of Davidowitz & Associates. This week, it is Applebee's that's in the news, announcing the closing of 160 Applebee's and IHOP locations. Howard, why is this happening?
Well, as you know, the whole retail business is overstored, oversaturated, and tens of thousands of stores of all types are closing. Malls are closing, outdoor centers, indoor centers, strip centers, power centers. Everything is cutting back and closing. So this is part of that. When you look at the food industry, what are the growth areas? One of them is grab and go. That is the number one thing that threatens casual dining. Because you go in, you grab your sandwich, you grab a drink, you're done, you're out. And that's exploding. By the way, it's exploding in every supermarket. It's exploding in drugstores. The Target food stores have it. The small Target stores focus on grab and go. Everybody's focused on grab and go. That affects casual dining. Now, if you're in the casual dining business and you're healthy, like Panera, or you're fresh, or you're something special, or you got breakfast all day, blah, 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 that's terrific. But if you're just a normal, straightforward dining, casual place, you may have a problem, you know, pastas and salads and everything else. That may be a problem with the millennials. So it's not surprising. We have too much of everything. Also, if you've got a location and some of the key players in that location close, and you're a casual dining restaurant, guess what? You're screwed because there's a lot less traffic coming to where you are. So these massive changes in retailing are affecting every location and are affecting the real estate dramatically. So you may go down as no fault of your own. It's just that what you thought was a good location suddenly becomes a bad location. That's happening every second.
And now in the Washington Post, Howard, they're writing about Applebee's and talking about the corporate strategy had been to rebrand it as a millennial hangout, as like a place, you know, with a bar scene at night, et cetera,
There's
et cetera.
No Wi-Fi.
And now they've just thrown in the towel, said, no, we're going back to it. It's a family destination, 2-for-20 menu, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's what they've always been. I think for them to convert literally would be impossible. So, they are who they are. And
Howard, I got to tell you, I lived in upstate New York for about almost 2 years. In Elmira, New York, it's a very tiny town. There was nothing going on. Applebee's was not casual dining. Applebee's was when you wanted to impress your date.
You take her
to Applebee's.
By the way, I totally got that. I totally understand that. By the way, I've been in Elmira many times.
Oh, boy.
I understand that totally. I'm with you on that. However, all right, in a small town, I think absolutely that's the case. To casual dining and movie may be a situation where you can most impress your date because it's not just cruising the mall and having a Coke.
Yeah.
I mean, I got that, and I understand that. But there's not enough of that. They're not closing all their locations. I'm saying parts of retailing are being affected every minute because of the dynamics and massive closings and massive overstoring and massive everything we see in the business. Again, what are the growth areas? Grab and go. Supermarket is into that.
It's a generational, I mean, it's an amazing generational shift, and I've seen it. Even in hotels, the Holiday Inn Express has like a counter right at the check-in desk where you can just grab a sandwich and a large oversized, you know, chocolate chip cookie the size of a Frisbee.
Let me tell you something. The Hilton Hotel in New York, which has 2,200 rooms. I'm not saying it's clearly not the most exclusive. It's a Hilton. But it has 2,200 rooms. Well, I happened to walk in there last week. They have a major grab-and-go.
Yep.
The Hilton. They got this giant thing where you can grab a sandwich, you can grab this, you can grab that, a drink. That's in the lot. That's in a hotel with the most rooms in New York City.
Yeah, it's just, you know, we did this story and we had a lot of laughs at it, that millennials don't want to eat breakfast cereal because they don't want to wash the bowl and the spoon. Mm. And the cereal industry is trying to figure out how to get, you know, millennials to eat Captain Crunch. But the truth is that breakfast wraps and what you call grab-and-go food, that's how we're eating. There's an enormous number of people in this country that are eating dinner while standing up over the sink.
Yeah, who has time to go to Applebee's and get your Riblins? You got to, you know, most of us are just eating at our desk.
There's a huge change. And anytime you're caught in the middle, like the department stores are, anytime you're caught in the middle, it's a bad place to be because there's no growth. And that's where they are.
Is it, you know, the fine dining, so the upscale places, we're also hearing that they're hurt because millennials, again, don't want to eat at places with tablecloths. But it would seem to me that, like, luxury goods sort of have their own universe. They make their own weather. And the low end, obviously, there's a lot more people who are willing to grab cheap, quick food. So the Applebee's, there's got to be all kinds, TGIF, there's got to be all kinds of restaurants that fall into this category. Fuddruckers, there's all these places that sort of fall into that category.
Bennigan's.
And some of them have found ways to provide entertainment. See, it just depends how smart you are.
Howard, don't you think what they should do now is kind of make it ironically hip to hang out at an Applebee's? You know what I mean?
Here's what I learned in my life. If you're in a business, right, and I've been at this a long time, and I watched a lot of people try to change their core business. If you're in a certain kind of business, and you wake up one morning and you try to change your image, your chances of success are about 1 in 100,000. Who changed their image and was successful?
Domino's.
Domino's. But how many? One out of a gazillion. It is very hard to be in business a long time and say, okay, look, what we're doing doesn't work. We got to do something else. You go right to bankruptcy court. So I've been down this road. I can't tell you how many people with financiers and everybody. We're going to go from this to this. No one believes that you're what you say you are. It's a very hard thing to do.
Well, when your name is Applebee's, it's, you know, it's real hard to make that. Like,
not going to do it. Yeah. No matter what
Because the name itself comes like it came from some think tank, you know, focus group. It's
doesn't
not organic
anyone
to anything. It's like American is apple pie and Aunt B from, you know, from Mayberry. And we'll combine the two and it'll be. And that's not where you're not getting laid in an Applebee's.
Exactly. That's the bottom line. And it's a very hard changing an image. Get ready for a 15-year project and losing a fortune.
All right, Howard, thanks so much. Davidowitz and Associates. There's all kinds of problems going on here in California. And this is a combination of factors. One, one-party rule, because you don't have a real opposition party anymore. And two, a complacent and greatly reduced news media that doesn't spend a lot of time up in Sacramento. They lost interest once, you know, the movie star was no longer the governor. And we did, you know, we don't know, you're going to make California for the Californians.
California.
so they're not that interested anymore. And that's a shame because there's an awful lot of things that need to be covered. And one of the guys who is covering it is Joel Fox, co-publisher of Fox and Hounds Daily, and, of course, a professor at Pepperdine University. Welcome back to the show, Joel Fox. Joel, how are you?
I'm good, Doug. Thanks for inviting me back.
The ethics commissioner had secret meetings with Democrats over the recall election rolls. We saw this story, and this is Commissioner Brian Hatch. He's an ethics commissioner, and one of the things that is just laughable up front is that Brian Hatch's previous job was he was a lobbyist for the Firefighters Union. So he's on the ethics panel, and it's not that lobbyists are inherently unethical. It's just that that's the swamp. That is the swamp.
Yeah, and there's no question about it. I think give me a moment to give a little background about this story, and we actually have some kind of breaking news from yesterday on it. Imagine a large political chessboard for all these moves that I'm going to talk about. The opening move is the legislature passes a gas tax, 12 cents a gallon, new car fees. Tax increase requires a two-thirds vote, and that's the margin it passes by. Those opposed to the gas tax take an opportunity to make a point and change the political balance in Sacramento. Recall a legislator who voted to raise the tax. So who do they choose? Well, one Republican voted for the tax, but he's about to be termed out. So the next move is made on the board by the Republicans. Go after a vulnerable Democrat, one who was just elected by a small margin and a bit of a surprise, and that is Senator Josh Newman of Fullerton in Orange County. And by the way, if he's replaced by a Republican in a recall election, which is a strong possibility, the Democrats lose the two-thirds supermajority they need to raise taxes and to create other mischief in the eyes of the Republicans. So a recall petition is filed. The signatures are gathered. Rather quickly, in fact, the poll shows voters are not happy with this proposed gas tax, and it hasn't even been collected yet. If things go according to plan, the recall qualifies for the ballot, and the governor has to call a special election for the recall this year. Now, special elections are at off times and usually have lower voter turnouts. Statistically, Republicans turn out in higher numbers proportionally than Democrats. So the Democrats want to protect Newman and change the odds of the recall. So back to the chessboard, the next move. The Democrats pass a bill to change the rules of the recall. The bill says voters who sign the recall petition have more time to change their minds, remove their names from the petition. In addition, the state decides how much the recall is going to cost. And because they do that, it has budget consequences, and it takes effect immediately. So now the recall, if it occurs, will not occur on an off time, but next June in the primary, and that helps Newman. But then, and this is the new news, Doug, the other side, who wants the recall, files a lawsuit against this bill, and yesterday a court freezes the new law. Says a full hearing must occur and a decision on the new law must occur, which means the recall could happen before next June. I don't have a lot of details, I can't go beyond that, but it's very possible the recall will happen before next June. Now let's get to the point of what you talked about, Doug, and that is the Fair Political Practices Commission oversees the fairness of elections, the proper spending on elections, ethics, as you point out, and transparency. We should note that. So the rule, in effect, is that legislators can give their colleagues in a campaign $4,400, no more. It's limited. That rule's been in place for some time. The Democrats want to give Mr. Newman more money, and they have it. They have big coffers with a lot of dollars in it, and they want to give it to help him fight the recall. So a lawyer for the Democrats contacts the Fair Political Practices Commission, Commissioner Hatch, as you point out, and they ask for a rule change. The argument they make is that there should be no limits on a recall because it's really a ballot measure rather than a candidate campaign. The general counsel of the commission says, nope, this rule's been in effect for 10 years, and we should leave it in place. They only can give the limited amount of money. And then, as you pointed out, Doug, this attorney goes to Commissioner Hatch, the former union representative, sympathetic to the Democrats. He makes a motion that the rule should be changed, brings it up in front of the commission in July, and there's a preliminary vote to change the rule and allow for all these donations to be made to the Newman campaign. And now it's probably important that he gets that money if, in fact, the election is moved up. they're going to need a lot of money fast. The final vote on this, last point, is this Thursday. The change in the rule has been proposed. It's in front of the commission. Preliminary votes seem to support the change in the rule. This Thursday, they confirm it. So that's the background. Sorry it was so long and detailed.
Now, I'm glad that you went through the weeds with this, because here's what jumps out at me as you go through the thicket. How much time is spent in legislative councils, in government, micromanaging problems like this, triangulating ways around the will of the people, in essence, and just basically the system taking care of the system? I watch what goes on in Washington right now with all the Russian inquiry and all of the various scandals around the Trump White House, and how many man hours are consumed in the White House just dealing with getting ready for testimony. The same thing went on during the Monica Lewinsky days in the Bill Clinton White House. I just keep looking between fundraising and messaging and spin and concocting arguments to explain away the inexplicable. Or, you look at this, and I really do believe that when folks hear you walk through, this is why they throw up their hands about Sacramento or City Hall or fill in the blank, and they just go, a pox on all their houses, screw it, I don't want anything to do with it. I just give up.
And it's very much lawyer-driven, and it's very confusing. You can go on the website of the Fair Political Practice Commission and go to their agenda and see the proposed change in the law. And if you understand it, I'll give you a dollar.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And you see, this is I often reference, and I go back to a guy named Joe Edmiston. And Joe Edmiston, for over probably now 35 years, has run the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy and the Mountains Recreation and Conservation Authority.
I know Joe. He actually reads Fox and Hounds.
The SMMC and the MRCA. And his stated objective is a noble and worthwhile thing, which is to preserve open space so that every mountaintop in Southern California isn't flattened and McMansions built, okay?
Right.
So I don't have a problem with what his raison d'etre is, but the methodology is atrocious, because he has set up a perfect political machine where there's no check and balance. He's diffused his power across everywhere from Washington, from the National Park Service to the state parks, to the Conejo Valley Recreation, and you can't vote him out. And he controls, I think, more land than the entire state of Delaware within California. He's enormously powerful. Sits in Barbara Streisand's old mansion up there in the Santa Monica Mountains, charges people to come see it. So, but the thing is that I believe that what he has done to preserve his power has been replicated over and over and over again, which is make it complex, make lots of initials. This is what's going on in the West Side with the Vision Zero and Mobility 2035 and Great Streets. Let's get three or four different things that have overlapping jurisdictions. And it's not really Great Streets. It's not really this. It's not really that. The Department of Transportation is taking the lanes away. And then by the time you try to unscramble it, your busy life, it's impossible to follow, because you've got a life to lead. And they've got 24/7 and publicly funded attorneys that walk them through it.
That's right. It's attorney-driven. They have consultants to come up with slogans that sound good. And if you try to undo it, then all of the knots are almost impossible to follow. If you read these bills, if you look at that agenda item I just referenced, it talks about sections of the code and other sections of the code. And if you don't have a volume of law books in front of you to follow that, it's really difficult. And that's why, so one side gets their lawyers to fight the other lawyers. This issue that we're talking about, I told you the general counsel of the Fair Political Practices Commission originally said that it's an appropriate position of the commission right now. We should leave it alone. So what the Senate Democratic lawyer did is he went to the head of the Senate, Mr. De Leon, asked him to consult with the lawyers in the legislature. They came up with a different opinion, and so now it was lawyer versus lawyer, lobbying versus lobbying, and the result seems to be that they're about to change the rule. Now, It's possible, Doug, because of all the publicity, people like you focusing on it and bringing the attention of what looks like, I mean, the ethics folks around the state have recoiled about this. The transparency, while nothing illegal has been done, the commissioner was supposed to reveal that he had these discussions and he didn't do it. So maybe all of this negative publicity toward the way this was handled might change the vote this Thursday. I will emphasize the word might.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, Taylor Swift got a dollar judgment against a country western disc jockey. And,
yes.
You know, and these are very big stories that have to be covered. So, you
it's
know.
It's a lot easier to understand the grab of the butt than it is to the grab of the taxpayer dollar.
Oh, that's exactly right. And it's really demoralizing, but it's important information. And, you know, I know that the audience that chooses to listen to this show cares about this stuff. I just wish that there were more people who would get involved like you have. We're powerful, grateful that you can go through the thicket and walk us through the process. But it is overwhelming because every time you turn around, it seems like there's another thing that you've got to contact your elected officials or sign a petition for or get out for a special recall this or, a primary that. And at some point, I think that it is contributing mightily to the lack of participation where people are just saying, you know something, I'm going to get involved in my community. I'm going to do something in some other way rather than this because it seems like it's a lost cause. Joel Fox, yeah, thanks so much. Fox and Hounds Daily, check that out. And, of course, he has some students who are very lucky to have him as a teacher at Pepperdine University. Joel, thanks for being with us. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Doug.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
95.5 KLOS. Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
So we told you about CalPERS. Every year we get a new report from Transparent California. And the number of six-figure pensioners who work for the taxpayers keeps going up and up and up. Almost 23,000 CalPERS retirees now collect pensions north of 100,000. Actually, yeah, there's 23,000 of them. And when you look at all government employees, it go up to 53,000 retired public employees get pensions of at least $100,000. Joining us to talk about it is Robert Fellner from Transparent California. How are you, Robert? Welcome back.
Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we even get into the numbers here, Steve Maviglio attacked you in the pages of the LA Daily News and the Press Enterprise and all the Southern California News Group by saying, Transparent California is neither transparent nor in California. It's a Nevada-based anti-union group that refuses to disclose its donors. So the irony of publishing the salaries of teachers, firefighters, school bus drivers, and other public servants shouldn't be lost on anyone. Well, what do you say to that? Because, first of all, it's not a rebuttal to the data.
Ding. That's, you know, the guy has paid a lot of money to be a lobbyist for public unions. And to me, that's the greatest validation of our work you can get, is after years, all they can do, and I mean, we've put out dozens of reports that have been covered hundreds, if not thousands of times in the media, and there's never one dispute about the accuracy of the data because it's completely accurate. It's the standard attack the messenger. You know, I don't know why being in Nevada means we can't calculate numbers. I don't see how that is relevant. And of course, the other thing is that, you know, we're a private nonprofit and therefore we don't disclose our donors. But, you know, that's the big distinction is we're private. We're, you know, people contribute to us who value our work. Public employees, of course, are funded by taxation, so there's a right to know where that money is being spent. So I don't mind it. I mean, to me, it's, you know, his job is to attack us. His livelihood depends on it. So I don't ever expect him to say anything complimentary, but if all they have is this attack the messenger smear campaign, to me, that's a badge of honor. It's the, you know, they acknowledge the data is completely correct, and
well,
they want to change this the topic.
You can oftentimes declare victory by the quality of your enemies.
Right.
Now, with that said, you know, I'm 100% in favor of public employees making a good living and having a decent retirement. We need cops. We need firefighters. We need sanitation workers. We need teachers. God, do we need teachers? We need road maintenance people. We need all of the things that we want to have a modern society, and we don't want people to work their lives in public service and live in penury. But we also don't want the rest of us to live in penury either, paying their retirements.
Right. I mean, that's the whole rub of the issue, is these compensation packages are being funded through taxation on people who on average earn much less. So, I mean, if I could flip a switch and say I want everyone to make $100,000 or more in retirement, I would do it. I mean, it's not saying we don't want that. Like you said, I want everyone to make that much money. But is it fair, is it sustainable to provide that when it's coming literally at the expense of those who on average earn much less themselves? To me, that doesn't seem fair nor sustainable.
You know, Robert, this is, you know, obviously not your bailiwick, but I want to throw it out for what it's worth. We bring this up a lot. I think that one of the real problems that modern conservatism has, and the Republicans specifically have, is that one of the foundational philosophies is that private sector jobs are better than public sector jobs. And when I say better, I mean they're better in this sense, that they pay into the social welfare system. They pay in without drawing out. The salaries are generated by private funds and the profits of the corporations, not from the taxpayers. Whereas, you know, a cop or a firefighter obviously providing an important, critical public service, and by the way, one that I'm too cowardly to do. But their salaries and retirements are paid for with taxpayer money. So even though they pay taxes, they're also drawing out of the tax base. The problem here is that in far too many cases today, private sector jobs are crappy jobs. They're not offering good salaries with a decent pension in retirement. Public sector jobs are. When you see a city that puts out the for hired shingle, there's a line around the block. Right. And in a lot of cases, corporate America is producing working poor jobs and subsistence level working poor jobs, which is a real problem.
Right. And I mean, to me, the solution to that is not to further raise the taxes on those people struggling, right? I mean, that's the rub, right? I mean, the public guys say everyone should do this. But the reason they're able to increase their wages and benefits so far above the market is because they're funded through taxes. And unlike a private business, which has to voluntarily get customers, you can afford to spend much more when you force people to pay for your product. So I agree with you, and I think, you know, there's a lot of things we can look at in terms to how to make it easier and better to create better paying jobs. But I think the last thing we should start with is saying, well, let's start by raising their property taxes, their water rates, their sewer rates, their sales tax to help fund these, you know, much richer pensions and benefits for public.
Well, and just even on a broader sense, what we're doing is unsustainable. In New York City, and this is a couple years ago, so it may be more lopsided now, the New York Fire Department, the NYFD, was spending dollar for dollar to pay the pensions and retirement of former firefighters that they were paying to operate the current fire department. And that just becomes financially unviable. I mean, if Republicans are accused of being anti-science, then Democrats are anti-mathematics.
Right. I mean, that's a good way of framing it. You know, this is an issue of math. I mean, can you afford it? Can you continue to afford, I mean, especially in California where your guys' cost of living is so high, you already have the highest tax burden in the nation, and you know, all the proposals being floated are just how do we keep paying this is to keep raising taxes. You know, I read a couple months back they jacked up the cost of car registration, things like that. So to me, you know, I don't see how it helps, which an admitted problem is we need to do things to improve private sector jobs, is to keep increasing the burden on the cost of living, the taxes and things like that on the private sector. You know, why can't we cut them a break? That's my response.
TransparentCalifornia.com is the website. TransparentCalifornia.com. Research Director Robert Fellner, thanks so much for being with us. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
Close to home, as you know, Southern California is home to one of the largest communities of Armenians in the world.
I think it's almost bigger than Armenia.
Right. And for some inexplicable reason, the world and specifically the United States government still will not call it what it is, which was genocide in the wake of World War I. when a million Armenians were killed deliberately by the Turkish government. And this has been a fight that's been going on for a very long time. And a group has put up a billboard, wants to put up a billboard at the Americana shopping center in Glendale. And they've been told that the billboard is unacceptable and they won't take the ad. To talk to us about it right now is Artin Manukian, chairman of the Glendale chapter of the Armenian National Committee of America. Welcome aboard, Artin. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Appreciate you coming on. So talk to us about what is the billboard?
Actually, the billboard is about a documentary film called Architects of Denial, which depicts mass exterminations perpetuated during the Armenian Genocide. And as you said, that remains unrecognized by the Turkish and the American governments. Actually, the film itself is composed of testimonials, insights provided by survivors and eyewitnesses at the same time. And there is an expert historian analysis, and it does emphasize the connection between the atrocities committed in the past and the crimes against humanity that continues today. And when the producer wanted to put the ad, in the last moment, Caruso affiliates and Americana's management did reject it, saying it's too political.
Well, you know, since when is that something that we can't handle in America?
I mean, tell me about it.
You know, we may have political films all the time. I mean, every film Michael Moore makes is political, and we take ads for it. So why can't we take ads for this?
It was very puzzling to us, you know, like you are, you know, by denying the Architects of Denial documentary film is like denying advertising space to a Holocaust film like Schindler's List or The Diary of Anne Frank.
You right.
know, basically, you know, the whole thing, you know, it's unfortunately that escalated to this. You know, it has been more than 2 weeks right now. This is something not just it's about the billboard and the record and the placement of a documentary film, which is, by the way, you know, it's a moral obligation and humanitarian, you know, obligation for all of us to really raise awareness about genocide, so it doesn't get repeated. As you know, in our world at this time, from Syria to Iraq in the recent days and weeks and so forth, we're seeing mass exterminations and massacres continuing. And it's unfortunately that the Caruso affiliates and its managers feel this way, and we. Not only, as I said, you know, this is something that a total insult to a population, I mean, to the half population of your city, which had ancestors, that survived the Armenian Genocide.
Yeah, well, certainly that's the case in Glendale, as an enormous population. You know, this issue is so relevant, not just because it's a local issue, but it's what we're talking about with Civil War monuments. Why are we arguing over things that happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago? Well, we're not arguing over the past. We're arguing over the present, that the acknowledgement of these things are not to wallow in it, but to take responsibility for it and to understand how they shape the present and where we go from here. The Turkish government's refusal to address what happened between 1915 and the 1920s basically, to the Armenian people as a deliberate governmental policy, I certainly understand why they're reluctant to face it, because it's an incredibly ugly chapter of Turkish history, but it's real. And you can't get better unless you have an accurate diagnosis. You can't go to the doctor and say, I feel bad, and then want the doctor to lie to you about what's wrong with you. You got to have the truth, even if it's an unpopular truth or an unpleasant truth. And we've allowed this to happen, America, because Turkey, as you know, is the only Muslim nation that's part of NATO. And therefore, we don't want to alienate the Turks. And for the Turks, they push back so strongly against this that we've walked up to the line. Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, he used the G word, the genocide word, but it never became official policy.
Correct. The struggle continues in that sense. We have to continue educating, raising awareness, calling upon our officials and politicians to make sure that they do the right thing, you know. And I agree totally with you. With this, Americana is totally colluding with the Turkish lobby and the Turkish government, and they therefore making the Armenian American population feel unwelcome in at the Americana.
Well, are they? Is there actual evidence that this collusion, or is it just cowardice that they're just afraid of offending
somebody? Actually, what outraged the community is that a response letter from the Caruso affiliates to the producers. By the way, both producer Montel Williams and Dean Cain are very prominent stars. They're very convinced that this happened, and they went all the way to Armenia to look into this and all that. So basically, we have in the response letter, unfortunately, the Caruso affiliates mentioned that they got a call from the Turkish lobby, and they want to stay neutral in this. This is not only too political, but it's within the international politics. Something that, you know, it's as I said, it still shows their insensitivity towards towards a large segment of the population, the issues that concern them, total neglect of the sentiments that exist in that population. And, you know, frankly, you know, they preach something, and they do, and they, I mean, their word, their deeds doesn't match their words. You know, they always say that we operate with a policy of inclusiveness, which dictates that everyone should feel welcome, you know, but that's not the case at this point. And today we are holding a press conference, and we are going to take some course of actions, and we are announcing a total boycott. And we are demanding that they rectify their mistakes, allow the advertising to be placed on the billboard. But also, as I mentioned, the damage has been done, and to repair that damage, you know, all those years of neglect and disregard towards the Armenian American community, I think they, you know, they comprehend the severity of the damage they best upon us. As an Armenian American community, and hopefully they realize that they need to reverse their decision and start building a relationship with the Armenian American community based on a mutual respect, and also based on understanding the sensitivities and the dynamics of the Armenian American
community. All right, Artin, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue to cover this. We appreciate you being with us. He's the chairman of the Glendale chapter of the Armenian National Committee of America. Well, I think without argument, it's not oranges, it's avocados that run this place, because we got to have our guacamole.
Got to have it.
But there's a problem, because there is a guacamole shortage, and this could send the price of guacamole soaring. And by the way, it's not exactly cheap. A wholesale box of 60 avocados currently goes for about $80,
oof,
or $1.33 per avocado.
I pay $3 at my store.
And it could go significantly higher. Well, that's probably the wholesale price.
Yeah.
Let's find out from this. The California Avocado Commission Vice President, Jan DeLizer. Jan, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Everybody likes avocados.
I like that thinking.
And that may be part of the problem. So many people like avocados. It's not just California anymore. They've gone global.
That's very true. We've seen the global demand for not just for avocados, but for Hass avocados go up really exponentially in recent years. Europe is eating more. Asia is being introduced to them and liking them more. Japan's been a pretty good market for many, many years. But there's a lot of interest in consuming avocados, and as you know, there's many different ways to eat them, and I think people are really getting on board with the fact that they're a healthy option now.
I grew up in New York, and we had no idea what Mexican food was. We had Cuban restaurants, and we had Puerto Ricans, but we didn't have Mexicans when I lived in New York. And I remember when the first Mexican restaurant that I could remember was a place called the Caliente Cab Company on 10th Street down in Greenwich Village. And I didn't know what the food was. I didn't know the difference between a burrito from a sombrero. I had no idea what it was. And now you can't go 5 feet without passing either a restaurant or a food truck that's got some pizzazz to it, and usually a side of salsa with a guacamole option or an avocado, a big slice of avocado, And these things are, they're expensive because they're hard to grow. This is not an easy crop to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Hass avocado variety, which is the main variety consumed in the United States, is known to be an alternate bearing crop. So you will see a crop like we had last year, which was just over 400 million pounds in California. That is a solid crop. That allowed us to begin in, you know, early to mid-February, and we had fruit into September. And then you get into a year like this year, and we have a lighter crop, more in the, you know, just over 200 million pounds. And that's, you know, it creates a situation where we had a tighter window on availability. We went, we had a very good summer. The supplies into the marketplace were anywhere from 10 to 12 million pounds a week, which is a good production out of California. It just tightened the window of our availability, which is why you're seeing some shortages in volume availability right now.
And we're talking with Jan DeLizer, who is the California Avocado Commission Vice President, and you can check them out at californiaavocado.com, californiaavocado.com. Our oldest has become the Johnny Avocado seed of Santa Monica, and he plants them in random places. He takes the seeds, and we save them now at our house, and he's collecting. It's kind of nutty, but, you know, what, it's a harmless nuttiness.
Has he gotten into grafting the fruit over so that it produces fruit, trees?
Well, he hasn't gotten that far
Doesn't
yet.
Doesn't it take 8 years to produce fruit?
Right, it takes...
It's generally 3 to 4 now. There was a time where we used to say 5, but they're producing... The growers are efficient and doing all that they can to get them going faster, so it's generally 3 to 4.
He brought us a young avocado tree in the backyard. It's still in the plastic, pot, but... You know, we're trying to keep it from burning alive in the West San Fernando Valley heat when it's 138 degrees in the shade. You know, so they're fragile plants. They need a lot of care, and that's part of the problem, and that's what makes them. It's also, by the way, as I understand it, it's one of the tougher fruits to get to market without damage.
Well, that's one of the reasons that the Hass variety became the main variety of choice, because it ships well. It's got a firmer shell to it than the green skin varieties. You may recall the Fuerte variety was very popular really up until the 80s, and now you barely see a Fuerte variety, but it just didn't ship as well. It was a thinner skin. And the Hass variety does better, and it's also nice because you can control the ripening through the system. So wow. You can pick a fruit that's mature off the tree but not yet ripe, and then have it ripen up, you know, so that it creates a good eating experience for the
Well, consumer. You know, these days we could all use thicker skin.
Amen.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Jan. Appreciate you being with us. CaliforniaAvocado.com. It's Avocado Talk, folks. 800-222. Let's go to the phones. You're forward to get them.
That's my favorite kind of talk.
Watch the phones. Trust me. I have a serious hunch that given the news cycle, we would probably make people a lot happier if we just talked about avocados.
I would make you guys my signature guacamole with my signature hot pico de gallo, fresh made.
Let's do it. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.